Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is a podcast about a kitchen that's going to eventually blow up. There's going to be a few surprises along the way. Now, it's also a little bit of a journey. So the first time I did this podcast, it was a sort of a challenge, and I tried to walk and with it, and the plug that I have has become damaged, and it's, you know, it's on the way out. And so eventually on the way out, destroyed it. So I had a go at doing it, which is a nightmare for me because it's just, I'm in this cognitive rehab, and I've got to actually remember, construct things in sort of like a fading whiteboard. You write things up on the whiteboard and you come back and it fades and you get just the general thing. You lose the dot points and it's just, oh, pandemonium trying to get across. And you've just got to keep on pushing and pushing. This is the cognitive rehab of trying to put this all together. Now, one of the things I want to do is to actually inject a whole lot of science education into stories. So there's a fascination of the story, and as you listen, you say, oh, I don't quite understand it, but I'm listening to the story anyway. We're just going to catch onto the story of this person. We're going to call him Nigel, and he's going to eventually get a visit from Alice. And there's going to be a kitchen at the end of the story of that. Now, what we're going to do is Nigel's going to be in a particular position in Australia, and we're going to actually go through all the science and the history of getting to that position, and a bit of the journey Alice has to go, the sort of the landscape that Alice has to go across to Nigel, and then we'll just have the story to wrap up what's going on in that case. It's sort of like a classic boy meets girl kitchen blows up type of story. Okay, so let's start at the very beginning, which is at the beginning of time as we know it, as the Big Bang. And we don't have a real story for why the Big Bang, but we have a lot of evidence of the Big Bang. So within the first unbelievably tiny fraction of a second, much shorter time scale than you could record on any atomic clock, a fraction of that, the universe went from absolutely smaller than an electron or a proton, went up to about the size of a couple of atoms, you know, not much, but it happened really, really quickly. And when it came across, it was like a sort of a bubble of tomato sauce suddenly expanding. And so when you take it there, you can obviously see a little bit of character. Now, after that, it continued to expand till about the 10th, probably the 10th might be an example of it. I've got to really think about it. Size of our current universe, and it expanded fairly quickly over the first, 40,000 years, 400,000 years. I'm really not sure. I have to remember. I'm just going off the top of my head. And the important thing is that at this point, the universe expanded, and it expanded so quickly in that this process, the next process up, it kept the surface of its first initial burst. So imagine it's just born and it's blown up to a very large size, and we can see that surface. Now, here's a bit of it, here's the rub. Although it's expanded, it's not expanding into anything. It's actually just getting bigger. In fact, what happens is that we're actually inside the universe, and if we can look out with our telescopes, we've got the most powerful telescopes, and we've got telescopes which can see further and further back in time. And as you go back in time, the light gets redder, the universe gets redder, and eventually goes infrared, then it goes not quite radio waves, it goes microwave. And once we get microwave telescopes, we can look out and see what looks like a cloud layer, but a cloud layer 47, I think, 47 or 49 billion light years away. At that thing, there's suddenly a cloud layer. And of course, that's going backwards in time. That is the actual start of our visible universe, 40,000 years afterwards. Now, the great thing is that it's just like this extremely magnified version of the instant of the Big Bang. It's the most beautiful, beautiful thing to see. And so we can see after that, that's 13.8. It used to be 13.7 or 8, but since we've taken better and better photographs, we can see there's all little baby wrinkles in the universe across, and it's telling us that every point is the center of the universe. It's telling us all this information. And as we look back into the time, as it goes redder and redder, it slows down. It's sort of imagine your tape recorder tape, as you're listening to it, as it goes, hello, it speaks slowly. It takes you longer to listen to it. It takes roughly six times as long to listen there. So we can actually see back in the universe and see standard clocks, things happening, which we know happen at a certain rate, slow down. We can actually see how far things are away, but how much time has slowed down as you go. All this beautiful stuff. Let's go forward. Our galaxy is formed 10 billion years ago. Stars are born and died, and as they die, they go this entire bang, and they produce soot, and the soot the stardust, the tiny little grains of insignificant soot forms our Earth. And of course, we're going to start our story a little bit with our Earth. So our Earth's from the first generation star has exploded, and it's around a second generation star, which is our star, around 4.6 billion years ago, roughly. The Earth begins to coalesce. It has a collision, breaks into two, forms the Moon, which is sort of an important aspect of it. And the Earth forms. Now, we come to Australia. So, Earth, 4 billion years ago, 3.8 billion years, we get a piece of the Earth's mass, which is that old. And that is the size of Australia. Australia has been the most out of the way, leave me alone, well, it's going to be one bit of a story. It's going to be the old leave me alone continent. And around Western Australia, or the left-hand side of Australia, as you're looking down to it, is the most ancient part. In fact, the most ancient part of the Earth's crust. And all it's been doing, all Australia has been doing, is just weathering away, building up fantastic mineral deposits as seen nowhere on Earth. We have 96% of the world's high-grade uranium. We've got a good fraction of this world's steel, silver, lead, this thing that the conquistadors would have dreamt about. Australia has all sat there. That's in Western Australia. It starts to be a bit more modern as you go across to Eastern Australia, to where I'm actually broadcasting from, with the odd frog. Owl, and unfortunately, it just breaks my heart. There's a beautiful big tree which used to be there. They've just cut it down today. But put it aside, that's in modern time. 3.2, our part of Australia. Well, the place I'm sitting on, it's the really underneath part starts 300 million years ago, 150 million years ago, where I'm sitting on. In fact, my Glenbrook, the Glenbrook which I'm sitting on, has only come up in the past 3 to 8 million years. It's just been an afterthought. It's thrust up. Glenbrook's thrust up. Riverbed been thrust. I'll have to explain the riverbed up. It's been thrust up. And the creeks are going, what's this? And the mountains have grown either side of the creek, creating these gorges. It's not that the riverbed has cut down. It's always been cutting down, but it's uplifted, and so you've got this beautiful gorge system around here. But as I said, there's a riverbed. So around 300. So let's start off. I suppose we have to mention sight and sex, and we'll get from. If you got any kittens or young people, it's best to put your hands over their ears there. So around 50 million years ago, so we had snowball Earth, multicell organisms, took about a billion years ago, 500 million years to go, 500 million years ago, the origination of vision, and vision with sex. Part of vision meant that what you look like mattered. There was suddenly a lot more things were eating each other once they could see what they were eating. They wouldn't just sort of feel around, and you had to be clever. And you could possibly say that they could actually see their mates, but there's probably haps not them. And this is the C forms coming across. Now, I suppose first plants, then animals began to move out of the, you had multicellular animals and multicellular plants. The multicellular plants began to grow on Earth, and then the plants began to make this fantastic discovery. They began to make tubes. Now, if we're going to say plants, how do plants grow? Let's go across there. Plants actually grow out of thin air. They require water from the air and carbon dioxide from the air. A few odd little minerals about the place, but mostly those two things together. And it requires, again, nitrogen from the air, and that's not necessarily from the soil, it's from bacteria and fungus in their roots to make this type of stuff. So they make these vascular, these fine tubes, capillary tubes. So if you see a tree, the tree basically is watering itself all the way up top. It's got a very thin capillary straw going to the ground, so fine that the water will actually rise up to the top of the tree. That's how you pour water on the base of your tree. How does the water get up to the top of the tree? It's the capillary action. But this is an important aspect, because once this has really got going, this little part of Australia, which is part of Gondwana land, was covered by massive, massive conifer forests, coniferous time. This is before the dinosaurs. Amphibians were beginning to get on land at this point in time. Now, the important thing about this point in time is that you've got one or two amphibians. You've got backboned animals swimming about place. You've got plankton which are growing and dropping their skeletons of planktons. Now, we do promise that we will get to the kitchen, which is going to blow up at the end, a catastrophic blowing up and a bit of a punchline, but we want to go here. Now, this stuff, well, the chalk, Mrs. Marks's chalk, which you can break, or that the teachers write, that basically is poor old plankton skeleton, chalk. In fact, limestone, marble, all animals. And there was this fantastic thing happening about where we were. Now, although there were plants, there was not a lot of sort of lichen. Look, the important thing is that plants tend to eat rocks. Plants break up rocks. So if you don't have too many plants, and they haven't worked out how to grow too well, you can have these massive mounds. And when the plates push together, they pushed part of the earth up higher than Mount Everest, much, much higher than Mount Everest. And that, my friends, is Lithgow, just about 70 kilometres further west than here. It was the highest point on the planet. And behind the planet, the rest of Australia, between Western Australia and Australia, was a very shallow sea. Now, you will know that if you are your mum's told you to boil some water to make an egg, and you go around to play and forget about it, the water begins to boil really rapidly in that last couple of centimetres of water, because there's not a lot of water there. Same thing happened here. We've got a big shallow sea, and the shallow sea, any sunlight hitting it, heated it up. And when it heated up, it meant that heaps of water rushed in to fill it, and it steam came across. And the end result was this very shallow sea, and the Carboniferous carbon went back to the atmosphere. You had a very hot climate, and this produced a huge amount of steam and rain. And the rainfall was 10 times greater than it was today, this area, for millions, tens of millions of years, hitting the size of this Mount Everest. So 10 times as much rain hitting a huge mountain caused a river 100 times bigger than the Amazon flowed off this mountain at its uniform rate. How do we know about it? How do we know about this river? You walk around the Blue Mountains, you pick up any rock, and it's a piece of river stone, and it's got little pebbles in it. It tells you the weather, the rainfall, the actual full process of it all. It's a pretty amazing thing that we scientists can do. But we can do it. Now, you may choose to challenge us on things which directly affect your money, affect your livelihood and stuff like that. You tend to leave us alone just to keep on working these things out. Thank you very much. So we walk along and we see more and more of it here. And this mighty river stretched, began to flow over the old coniferous forests and laying down sandstone. And now, sandstone is sand and a little bit of grit. And when it heats up, the grit and the tiny dust forms to glass. So sandstone is basically sand which is held together in a glass matrix. Just want to tell you that. But that flowed for a long, long time. And that resulted in this mighty forest held under one of the world's largest, perhaps the world's largest coal deposit. 400 years worth of coal sitting under Sydney. It comes out of Newcastle and at Wollongong. This huge, huge coal deposit. Absolutely massive coal deposits sitting in the most mineral-rich country on Earth. What do we do? We just give it away, I think. But look, the story is, I think coal is our second biggest export. It's iron ore, coal, and education. Because we definitely haven't got any industry polluting around here. So that's them. So this huge mountain produced a huge sea, a huge river, and the river bed laid a river bed of sand, river sand, a kilometre thick. And so all the Blue Mountains, in fact out to Sydney, up to the continental shelf, was this huge river bed. And it's all very well until this went over a hot spot and actually bubbled it up and shot up the Blue Mountains and shot up all this intricately complex set of canyons which went through to form a submerged canyon system, which is Sydney Harbour, this beautiful thing. But let's move back to between Western Australia and the Blue Mountains, and we have this large sea, and animals began to grow. Lots of fish went along them, and they would die. Now, what could possibly happen to those fish? What we might get fossils. Well, Australia has fossils with a twist. Our fossils landed on this big flat area. Most of them disappeared. Some of them had this beautiful thing with this water and the sand, the silicon. The water moved out and displaced the bones, replacing it with tiny little spheres of sand, silica sand, Similar to the stuff you have in your taco mix, that those tiny little beads that says do not eat. I think you'd be pretty silly if you did eat it. Now, that formed and compressed over time, and that is Australian opals. And we have these large opal fields. So Australia also has the largest opal production on the planet, and Australian opals are to be beheld. They're these diffraction gratings of brilliant colours the light goes in. But this large, sludgy sea, all that happened is that it's like this silt on a bathtub. You don't see a lot of structure on the silt of your bathtub. If you have this bathtub, it doesn't clean out. It just builds up and up, this vast, flat plain. And this vast plain is perhaps the biggest featureless on the top. Underneath, it's one gigantic plankton skeleton, or limestone. It's calcium carbonate hitting across there. And so water across it builds this intricate cave system. And where the caves meet the sea, it forms these beautiful limestone cliffs, white cliffs of Dover. So that's chalk. This is limestone cliffs. So this huge, called the Great Australian Barrier, but this is a big, flat, hot land. And now the nutrients aren't in there, so there's no trees in it. It's just shrubland, 1,000 kilometres of shrubland and across there. Now this is going to enter our story, going to be in our story soon. But in Western Australia, you have a major city which is thousands of kilometres from any other major city. You might call Adelaide a major city. That's 1,500, 1,700, thousands of kilometres from Singapore, thousands of kilometres. It is the world's most isolated city. So it's actually quite a cosmopolitan city. But if you want to do isolation, you can find an isolated place not too far from that. Although you've got the great deserts to the north, if you go a little bit further south, it's not that bad. It's probably pretty much similar climate to which we have, the subtropical climate we have up here in Sydney. And so there's, if you really want an isolated place to go and work and study, it's where Nigel picked. And so he picked this place about 300 kilometres or 200 kilometres, not in the goldfields. In fact, there's massive goldfields out there as well, in Albany. Now, Albany used to be a whaling centre because, to do it, there is the highly fertile oceans around Australia, because Australia's eroding and it's putting out soil into the sea, which is fertilising this incredibly fertile sea. But beyond that, in the Great Australian Bight near Albany, there's it seems to be an oil ooze coming out into the ocean, which is producing abundant life and creating a column of intense life of whales and orcas and giant squid, sharks, incredible life out there. And so this attracted early whalers. An early whaling station was Albany. So coming up there is this site there. So you have Nigel, who's there, and he's decided that he's going to set up a shed to work on. And what he's also done is he's decided that what he's going to do is he's going to build a kitchen. And he's seen the kitchen design somewhere in his head, and he's going to put the back wall, the splat area there, with these dorky 1970s dark tiles, and he's going to make the cupboards not modern cupboards. He's going to put wood veneer on them and dorky cheap handles on it. Nice looking, but not that good. And he's going to use a standard cheap water thing, and he's got his shelves up the top there, and he's a bit unusual. He's got a fire extinguisher, which he's put in there, and a fridge over there, stuff like that. And he's set up and just going to get things going. And by and by, years pass, and bored one year, April sets across in her white, I think, BMW with her two dogs, which we're going to call Puppy 1 and Puppy 2, across the Nullarbor Plain. And this is this big, huge desert. And it's a single road, a single railway line, a single road which goes across. It's not quite straight road, because what happens is after every 50 kilometres, there's the road goes hard right, hard left, hard left, hard right. Continue where it is. It's a little wake-up bend. And what happens is that the truck drivers who are driving here days and days and monotonous travelling, this ferocious heat across here, goes across here. There used to be a wireless communication system across there. It's just remarkable. Yeah, there's just such a remarkable place to go across. So days and days of travelling, I think would take, it would take 3 days at, it's thousands of kilometres, so, you know, I don't know how you could possibly travel 1,000 kilometres in a day. I don't know, it's a couple of days of driving across. Eventually arrives there, and fortunately the dogs are hungry, and there's two plates there and some dog food there, and there's the kitchen there, and they're having a long there. And by and by, there's an idea which you really should redo the kitchen. You're out in the middle of nowhere, so fortunately, Nigel has planned ahead and put a few kitchen catalogues out and got some things together, ready. And it was, I think we should have a new kitchen. And Nigel says, yes, 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 we should. That's a good idea. And so there's the catalogues and the thing. And fortunately, Nigel knows in advance, knew in advance to order the stuff in. It's there. And Nigel's having a little bit of difficulty putting things together. And, you know, the screwdriver falls out of his hand and falls out the window and all this type of stuff. Things are just not going well. The different things don't fit in back to front. He's making heaps and heaps of problems. And then there's the idle question of saying, look, this is a bit unusual. What's that fire extinguisher there for? And Nigel says, I don't know, it's to hold up the cupboards above there, because it's a bit, and also for fridge fires. Fridge fires, fridge is cold. Who's ever heard of a fridge fire? Oh, I don't know how that will go. And so what happens is that more and more problems come across. Look, I'm going to consult the tablet. I've got a tablet I can scroll through, and it goes across, and just, I found it, and then the power goes, the power's gone. Do you know where the charger is? And Nigel says, the charger, I think I've got it there powering the fridge. That's insane. The fridge will draw so much power, that charger will not be able to, and it did, as they were speaking, it did overheat and burst into flames like that, and which is panic like this, stumbling back. It pushed over the central bench, which wasn't put together properly anyway in a place like that. And then Nigel went across and with some effort ripped out the fire extinguisher, put out the fire extinguisher, put out the the fridge, like that. And which April said, "This is a disaster. We will never finish this kitchen. We just cannot finish this kitchen." To which Nigel said, "We never will. You know, we never will. It'll be a lifelong work getting to it." At which the top cupboards, which were there, which were held up by the fire extinguisher, began to creak a bit, and the actual cupboards fell open and fell down and just poured out all these cans and cans of dog food. And the two puppies said, "It looks as though we're going to be here for a very long time." So that's the end. It started with the beginning of the universe. It ended with a never-ending story of working together on a kitchen which is doomed to failure. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.